And welcome back. Reconciliation and racial conflict, it has seemingly worked very well in post-apartheid South Africa. How well can it work here in the aftermath of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, the following turmoil, and after a number of incidents involving police and African Americans elsewhere? A community organization in Ferguson has launched what it calls the Truth-Telling Project to get at root issues of racial conflict in the interest of social justice. This weekend, it will sponsor a day-long event titled Violence in America, Exposure Through Truth-Telling. Joining me to talk about truth and reconciliation relating to Ferguson and elsewhere are Ferguson activist and pastor Corey Bush. She's with me in studio. And joining us by phone, Dr. Imani Scott of Savannah College of Art and Design and the author of Crimes Against Humanity in the Land of the Free, Can Truth and Reconciliation Heal America's Racial Conflict? Professor David Ragland of Bucknell University. He is a native of St. Louis and a founding member of the Truth-Telling Project. Thank you all so much for being with us, gentlemen and lady. Nice to have you with me in studio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Scott, I'd like to start with you. Give me a definition so that we're all understanding what we're talking about here of reconciliation in this context.
Okay, so in this context, reconciliation is a point that individuals reach after having experienced conflict where they go through the healing process, and it typically begins with apology and sincere apology, and then sincere forgiveness, and then programmatic measures and dialogue to help rebuild relationships. So it's about healing, and it's about building relationships to move us forward into a more peaceful existence and acceptance of each other and our differences.
Professor Ragland, am I correct in saying that it seemed to work particularly well in South Africa?
Well, I think it worked to a certain extent. And the goal in South Africa was in part to maintain, you know, that the state continue. But I think here in Ferguson, there has to be structural change first. And for us, you know, reconciliation is not just, you know, the apologies back and forth, but it's also structural change. And I think that's one of the ways that we see it. And in South Africa, it leaves a lot to be desired, but a lot of things did happen. They were able to continue on as a nation to some extent, but there's still the economic or the history of and the current legacy of economic injustice that sees a lot of people in poverty.
Well, that would certainly suggest, and I'll put this to you, Pastor Bush, that this is not an easy process, nor it is a fast process. And I don't think you expect it to be quick in Ferguson.
No, not at all. Actually, it's a bigger process than what I personally thought, because the thing is, when you decide, OK, I'm ready to heal, I'm ready to move forward. And then when something else happens, then you're wondering, well, then who am I reconciling with? You know, am I done with this? I'm seeing it again. So if the things are still happening, you know, even though I may have come to terms with it myself, but then when I see it happen to my family or my cousin or I'm seeing it in the news, then am I really ready?
Who has to have this conversation?
I think each individual has to know who it is first. How was I hurt? Who hurt me? You know, and then is that tied to something in other experiences that I have? And then going forward, having those conversations with not only the area where you were hurt, but then people that actually can help you, those counselors, people on the outside, completely on the outside, that, you know, not whether it's police or completely on the outside of those areas.
And Dr. Scott, you know, how do you approach the other side, those with whom you want to have this conversation?
I think that's one of the greatest challenges that we're facing, to be honest with you, because people that hold power don't typically yield that power willingly. I think that the oppressor in this country, typically it's been, you know, white Americans holistically, I think that they have held the power for so long, and I don't see them yielding that power until they begin to sense an incentive to do so. And I think probably one of the greatest incentives to do so and to engage them in this conversation, to engage the oppressor in this conversation, is to help them to realize the ways that our country is falling apart, I think, in many ways, by not having the conversation, by not having empathy and not having a deep regard and respect for persons of different types of color, you know, skin color or racial or ethnic background. So I think that it's not going to be something easy, especially in this country, because we've had this going on for hundreds of years. So I think we've got to help the oppressor to see the benefit in having the conversation so that they will want to come to the table.
But, you know, you just don't call a meeting. You can't do that.
No.
I mean, you've got to find a format, some sort of format and some venue to have this kind of conversation.
And it really goes beyond just having a conversation. I mean, you know, to say just having a conversation really minimalizes things, because there's no evidence that talk works 100% of the time. So it's really about helping each other to respect each other's humanity. And I think that one of the things that we see coming out of this experience in Charleston was so much pain that it even drew people together from different sides of the aisle to begin to say, wait a minute, you know, something needs to be done. Sometimes it may be something that's earth-shattering or something that really shakes up our society for us to get to that point.
Well, Professor Ragland, while we're on the subject of Charleston, and that's been a remarkable story from so many different angles, this is my personal opinion. I'm tired of hearing the word conversation. What I'd like to hear and see is action. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing in Charleston now.
Well, I mean, I think there is some action that's happening. But in part, I think the taking down of the flag, the ending of the Confederate flag is only part of the picture. I think in part, there has to be real economic opportunities for poor folk. There has to be, and not just poor black folk, poor white folk. And the real, I think some of the underlying issues are in part an unjust economic system that essentially makes it morally acceptable for, say, black folks to be the losers. If you have a system of winners and losers, you know, in part, black folks are often the losers because of the history and the systematic and ongoing degradation of black folks in this country. And there has to be some real structural changes that essentially change the way that our nation operates. And so I think that's, in part, there's some action, right? You know, the flag is just symbolic. Right, but the flag also represents a long history of denial of opportunity and denial of, you know, real participation in this society that has to happen.
Well, it is symbolic, certainly, but it also has gained some momentum now. Other states that use that flag somehow in official or semi-official capacity are also talking about making the change. So it seems to me that's an action start, at least of some sort.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so, Don, I just kind of wanted to comment on your the point you made about conversations. So when we begin to talk about truth-telling and we begin to talk about people having the conversations, it's not like the reconciliation ends with the conversation. The conversation opens the doors for the actuation of the type of structural change that Dr. Ragland is talking about. So we're not just talking about economic systems. We're talking about political systems. We're talking about our educational system. So there are a lot of different ways that racism is so deeply embedded in the web of the fabric of this country that it's going to take a lot to ultimately get past it. But it does begin with the open conversation, the truth telling about what really happened and what continues to really happen in this country.
I
think that's where the value in the conversation. But it's not the end. It's not the end.
I understand that. But Pastor Bush, let me turn to you on this, because it seems to me, and again, I want to get hung up on the word conversation, but there have been so many incidents over the years that we're all familiar with. And after every incident, it is said, we've got to have a conversation. We have a conversation, and then suddenly the talking stops until the next incident.
Exactly.
Are we farther along than that now as a result of what's happened in Ferguson and some of the events that have happened since? Because it hasn't stopped.
No, it hasn't. And it makes me think about a situation with myself. I attended a nonviolence training a few months back with Bernice King. And I remember just before I went to the training, I remember being tear gassed and, you know, and just it was just so much emotion and running up and down the street, being chased by the police. It was just so much going on. And then I went into this training and the police were in the training. And so and they made us talk to one another. And so, you know, I was really upset with them. I didn't want to talk to them. They didn't want to talk to me. You know, it was a situation. But then we were able to talk. But the thing was, and so that broke some stuff. The fact that we were put face to face. We didn't know each other would be there. We were able to talk. And I'm like, hey, you assaulted me. You did this. And they were like, oh, well, this happened. You know, so we talked to one another. But the thing was, as soon as we left, now everything was fine when we were in that space. As soon as we walked out of that space, went back down, some more things happened. Now we're getting tear gassed again. Now this is happening. And then that wall went back up, at least with me. So I can see that that's what continues to happen now. You know, we can have the conversation. But my question is, who then becomes the spokesperson? It's like, you know, we can have 80 conversations all over the country. You know, yeah, let's do this. Yeah, let's do this. Everybody get on the same page. But who is that one hurrah person, you know, that's going to say, hey, you know, everybody follow me. Now we're doing it. Now we're going to everybody's going to follow this way. We don't have that.
Leadership. You're talking, you need a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm not talking about a black leadership. I'm talking about it needs to come white from white leadership.
Sure. Have you had any conversations in Ferguson?
Oh, many.
I mean, have they been productive? I, you know, the kinds of things that we're talking about, this move toward reconciliation.
I would say a lot of brick walls. I would say brick walls. And it's like I said, it would be, you know, everything seems fine. You know, you yell and scream and then you come to some kind of a place. And then when you walk outside the doors, you know, it's different. When that person talks to this other person that's in their circle, then whatever we just talked about is gone.
Go ahead, Dr. Scott.
I just want to chime in on that for a second. And so this is one of the reasons that I am calling for. And a lot of people don't necessarily agree that this can happen or that it will happen, but for a nationwide truth and reconciliation process. Because it's got to be something, I think, that's driven by our government, and I think that it's got to be something that's infused in different states and communities, you know, all throughout our country. It can't just be we just have this one conversation in Ferguson because this happened, or we have this one conversation and the flag changes in Charleston and all of a sudden we expect magic to happen. You know, Congress actually apologized to African Americans and actually said that they would do things to help rectify all of the consequences that we're experiencing as a result of ongoing racism, and nothing has been done. And I think that's the perfect opportunity for our leaders, for our governmental leaders, to begin doing something on a national scale. So it can't be like having these little minute conversations in different communities and then people just go back outdoors and do the same thing. It's got to be a national commitment, shared responsibility that we've got to fix this, because if we don't, it's going to continue to tear our nation apart.
Professor Ragland, go ahead.
And I would just add on to that. Like, I think that's important, but I also think that the relationship between government and citizenry is strained, right? In part, we see, like, the federal transfer of military equipment that we see in our local communities. And there's a distrust, right, from the local to the national, but also local to just official.
Right.
And in part, like, the Truth Telling Project is a representation of civil society coming together and saying, like, all right, we should work and talk among each other about, you know, how we can transform our own communities and listen to each other and see how our voices can inspire possibilities for community. Because I think out of the tragedy, we can come up with ideas, right, that lead us to what's next. So while there's a need for sustainability, I think that if we do partner with government, that partnership has to be after civil society has gotten its act together and we've come together and started putting plans in motion. And then, you know, we invite government in, not as a partner to take control, but as a partner to assist in that sustainability. So I think there is possibility there, but I think it has to be done carefully.
Are you talking about local government or national government or both?
Both.
Well, let's be real about what's going on nationally now in terms of getting anything done, much less on something like this during a political season. I mean, to me, that's sort of an unrealistic expectation at this particular time.
I
don't see it as unrealistic because I truly see this snowballing. I mean, I see our country snowballing towards something that's going to be very, very ugly in a few years, if not sooner, if you just look at the trend of what's been happening in this country. So now at least we've got some political figures talking about it, and even like a Lindsey Graham, like taking positions that we never thought that he would take. Or we've got Hillary Clinton now talking about race when she didn't talk about it, you know, in her initial run for presidency.
Or even Thurman, exactly. That was quite a striking statement that he made last night.
Absolutely.
Let's talk for a moment about the truth part of this discussion. We talk about truth and reconciliation. Define that for me again in this context. What does that mean, truth and reconciliation? Who would like to take that? Professor Ragland, would you like to start it?
Sure. I mean, so we essentially see truth as the shared experience or the sharing of experience from the local experience. And I think, so truth-telling is happening in the streets, right? People are sharing their experience, and I think in part it's about grieving and sharing that pain. But also, you know, we see in the protests and people on the front lines of protests essentially like sharing their vision for society, a racist-free society, a police that's demilitarized. So in part, like, that truth-telling is something that occurs naturally, but truth-telling in the context of our project is essentially us providing a space or being part of a space where people come and share their truths, and that truth is in part taken down for the number one, so we can tell our own history, so that the local voice tells our history. And then so that history is also a part of, you know, documents that lead to recommendations for systemic change. But also, we have to be able to share and communicate what people are going through in this local experience to people around the world, because we need to know. People need to know. People need to connect with other people. And I think sometimes that pressure from everywhere else, as we saw here, and we see around the country, like, people around the world are tuning in to us and to this country and saying, like, what's going on in the U.S.? So I think part of that is definitely the shaming the systemic police violence, but also what are the root causes? And I think the truths that are expressed point not just to police violence, but the root causes that America allows to happen. The broader part of America allows this violence in urban communities.
Dr. Scott, hold on for a second. I want to put to Cori Bush here. Put that in, sure, that truth part of this in the Ferguson context.
Okay, so first thing is, like, Veggie, backing off of what Dr. Ragland said about the truth, my truth isn't your truth, and your truth isn't mine. Telling our own story is very important, because we lost that with Ferguson. The media told our story. Some media took it a totally different way. We would say one thing, and they said another, you know, printed another. And so I would say, My passion is my truth, you know, so you can't express my passion about those things that happened to me, you know, so give me the opportunity, give me that platform to tell my story, to let you feel, hear, and know my passion. And then the realness comes through. Then you're able to connect to what really happened, to what's really going on, versus someone else telling my story.
We only have a little over a minute left, and we'll give you, Dr. Scott, an opportunity to say something. You sounded like you tried to a moment ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine. So I think that Pastor Cori and Dr. Ragland have done an excellent job. When I think about truth in this context, and I'm thinking, of course, there is the truth. There is a historical truth that got us to this place where we are now. And then more in a more contemporary framework, there's the truth of the police officer. There's the truth of the victim. There's the truth of the witness. You know, there's the truth of the bystanders. This project that we have here is talking about engaging everyone and listening to each other's truth and hoping that we can develop a sense of empathy and a greater sense of understanding. And from that conversation, we can move towards some very practical, realistic changes in communities and in our nation. I think that's really what we're trying to get to.
It seems to me that if you can get two sides or more to sit down and talk, you're more than halfway there. Wouldn't you say so? You've got to agree to talk before you can make any progress.
Exactly. We've got to agree to talk. We've got to agree to listen. We've got to agree to talk and tell our truths. We've got to agree to listen. And then we've got to agree that something must be done. So it can't stop with the conversation.
But we have to be ready to, have that action that something must be done, too. You know,
we'll leave it at that. And we wish the best for you, Pastor Bush, with regard to conversations in Ferguson, certainly, and in other parts of the country as well. Yeah. I've got to end it there. I want to thank Dr. Imani Scott, Professor David Ragland, and Pastor Corey Bush. Thank you so much for being with us. Good luck
to
you all.
Thank you.
I'll point out that the Violence in America Exposure Through Truth-Telling event is going to be held this Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Cardinal Ritter College Prep. It will be keynoted by scholar and political activist Dr. Angela Davis. Again, thank you all for being with us. And tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with St. Louis Public Radio reporter Nancy Fowler about the journeys of two transgender men she has recently been following. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.